Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hello, Greenhorns. This is Severin. It's a Greenhorn radio session, radio about the young farming movement forward, progress towards the future we can eat and enjoy. And I have been already on the radio once before with Jacob Cowgold from Montana, but it's been a while. Oh, wait, it's not Cowgold, it's Kogel, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, I missed it. Once it's locked in, it's really hard. So, how's the haps over there? How's the weather where you are?
The weather is cold today. It's been kind of in a strange winter. It's been way too warm and not enough snow. But today it's about 12 above.
Way too warm and not enough snow. For you, that is 12 above. Yeah,
well,
that's the same over here.
This is a colder day. We've been having 40 and 50 degree days, which is really unusual for January and February.
So, what are we going to do about that?
Pray to the weather gods, I suppose.
Pray to the weather gods. Okay, hold on now. Back up. We got to give a little backstory. So, what's going on out there on the prairie with you?
Well, I think the last time we talked, my wife and I were just starting out, and that was 2009. We are currently on the same farm that we lease. We don't actually live on the farm. We lease about 15 acres, and we're in the same place for now. But we grow vegetables for a CSA. We grow heritage turkeys also for a CSA and for direct sales. And we're growing, on the majority of the acreage, we're growing ancient and heritage grains and seeds, which we also direct market and sell through a CSA.
And you're hyper tightly, you're very diversified, kind of similar to the kinds of farms that were originally homestead type farms out there. And how's the success and how's the challenges?
Well, I guess I'd have to say it's been pretty successful, given that neither of us have had any significant background in farming, and neither of us have had significant background in starting a business. So I'd say after 3 years, it's been a pretty good success. It hasn't been easy by any means, but we've been happy. We have there's always the same challenges of any young farmer, which is access to land, which we've somewhat solved, although it's not a permanent situation that we're in, so there's always that issue. Access to capital, we've been able to avoid taking on any major debt, but we did raise money from friends and family at the beginning, and then we've also purchased a tractor on credit, and we haven't had any trouble getting access to that kind of capital. But since we don't own a farm, we don't have to worry about trying to get a loan for that. And then skills and knowledge, I think that's just going to come with time. You know, every year that we make our mistakes, we'll learn from them, hopefully not repeat them the next year.
Well, and both you and your wife have very sensibly kept your day jobs. Now, that's not everybody makes that decision, but some people do. And could you reflect on that's obviously a lot of extra work to do two jobs instead of just focusing on one job. But what does that mean for you in terms of the farm?
Well, actually, we have not kept our day jobs. My wife has. It's a bit of a saga, but essentially, last year. Excuse me, 2010, I had a full-time job, and my wife worked a little bit part-time, but was mostly freelance work. And then as we went through the 2000 and 10 season, in that situation, it was pretty clear that it was just too much. My job was an hour away, so it was a one-hour drive each way every day, and a lot of travel in there too, and the farm really suffered for it. And so when winter hit and we started thinking about the next season and how we were going to pull it off, we made the nonsensical decision for me to quit my full-time job with benefits, for her to pick up some part-time work, and we went out on the open market for health insurance, which was an awful experience, but we found something. And that was last season. So last season I was full-time farming and she was part-time working, part-time farming, part-time child raising. And
Isn't there a baby in the mix here someplace?
Yes, there is a baby in the mix. So Willow was born 2010, near the end of 2010. And so 2011 was with a small baby. That was, every year has had its own unique challenges, and every year has been completely different. So who knows what this year is going to be like. But I'm full-time farming, which is, you know, when we made the decision for me to quit my full-time job, it was based on knowing that the farm was going to suffer at best and more than likely just fail. So that's why I quit my full-time job. And with little baby, that was kind of a hard decision, but that's what we did, and we pulled it off last year, and we hope to pull it off again this year.
So you're pulling through, and the little baby is successfully born and survived, because that's the other thing. It's like once they make it, they're like little baby animals. They get stronger every year. What's next? Any big changes? New company out on the prairie? What's going on in the scene?
For us or for the neighborhood?
For you and for the neighborhood.
Well, for us, we've spent the last, well, pretty much since we've started farming where we are now in 2009, we've been trying to figure out a way to secure some land and more importantly, secure a farm, you know, buildings and house and land. And we've gone through multiple scenarios and none of which have worked out, and it's been a bit of a roller coaster. And so this last year, we came really close and came up short. And so we've gone through a bunch of different possible scenarios, and we might be getting closer to a more permanent location, which is just south of us now on my wife's dad's place. So that's kind of a big deal for us. We might be able to live on the farm, which has always been a challenge with the little one. And but that's not for sure either, so we'll just have to wait and see. As far as the farming itself goes, we're really excited about the ancient heritage grains. We grow what we call prairie farro, which is emmer, which is an ancient wheat. We grow a Sonora wheat, which is a heritage variety. We grow bronze barley and then some legumes, and we've been direct marketing those through our CSA and then to some individuals who want a few pounds here and there. But we've given our scale, it's big enough that we need specialized equipment for the grain. In other words, we need a combine, which we have. We need a swather. We need a grain drill. We need all those things. But in particular, post-harvest, we need the specialized cleaning equipment because we're big enough that we can't do it by hand, or at least we don't have the time to do it by hand. And yet we're small enough that most of the seed cleaning companies around us just won't even bother with us. And no fault of their own, they're working in 50,000 pound batches, and we're, you know, growing 2,000 pounds of any one thing. So we recently got a grant to purchase some seed cleaning equipment, so that's a big step forward, I think. And then the step after that will be to be able to mill those clean grains for customers, because we give them whole grain right now and give them lots of recipes on what to do with whole grain, but we aren't able to commercially grind flour. So that'll be our next step, is to put together possibly a mobile mill that we can take around different places and stone ground, stone grind people's grain. So hopefully this will all come together next or this year.
Well, it doesn't sound very ambitious at all.
No.
Trying to straddle. I mean, this is obviously, you know, continually the question, like, how do you scale up in an organic way from an operation where you're dealing with varieties that are either, you know, ancient or you know, adapting those heritage grains and getting your systems all up and going. And then getting it to the scale where you can actually plug into even just a bakery, the demands and the rhythm and the expectation that they have, having dealt with, you know, flour by the pallet, it's quite a coupling to make.
Right.
Do you think that you'll be able to sell to a bakery even this coming year, or is that the next year, or 3 years from now, or?
You know, I'm not going to make it a primary goal to do it this year. Our first step is to simply get the stuff put together, the cleaning equipment in the mill, and then get our CSA customers flour if they want it, and then also direct market to other individuals. You know, since it'll be a mobile mill, and we're kind of fond of the idea of calling it a micromillery, but set it up at farmers markets so people can come up and buy their whole grain, and then we grind it for them, and then they have absolutely the freshest flour they can possibly get, short of having their own mill, and see where that goes. And in the meantime, we'll start to visit with bakeries, and we know that we can't compete with the flour that we can't compete with the companies that are providing bakeries with flour now. So we have to take a different tact. We have to tell bakers to try our flour for specialty things. So in other words, not try to replace the
flour. Like smaller runs of things or special local loaves or that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. So make it about the variety that we're growing, because we're not growing a general all-purpose white. We're growing a specific varieties, and so the bakers will have to highlight that in their bread when they sell it, because it is part of the story, but also we won't be able to sell it for pennies like they're used to getting it. And also we're not going to be able to, at least at the beginning, provide them with the same exact flour with the same exact amount of protein every single year. It's going to be a lot like selling it like you might grapes for a bottle of wine. It's going to be about that taste of place, and it's also going to be about the season. So we'll have to be able to communicate with our bakers to say, this, you know, this year's crop of Sonora was excellent and it has these sorts of qualities, whereas, you know, the 2011 crop, because of the season, has these particular qualities. So each year's going to be different. As commercial flour is blended in order to produce the same consistent flour for bakers, so they don't have to worry about changing anything. They just use the flour year after year the same way they did the previous year. So it's going to be a totally different concept for bakers, and at the same time, it's going to be up to us to try to tell them that story of the grain and convince them that they should use it. And I don't know if we are going to be able to, but that's the hope. But that's a lot of work ahead of us. So we're not going to push the bakeries just yet until we just figure out these things on our own.
Well, and so for those who are also thinking about small grains, and I've been going to wonderful conferences on wheat growing, and there is tremendous interest right now in growing grains, local grains, milling, these older varieties of farro and spelt and kamut and rye in rotations, you know, as part of a CSA operation, as a value, as a thing to put as an extra crop for a diversified farm. But then there is also tremendous interest in the baking, in the artisanal baking world. There's a kneading conference in Maine, in Skowhegan, Maine, and now there's one that Stephen Jones of WSU is run for the first time last year out in Washington State. And I went to that and, you know, met literally there were 13 ovens set up at the same time, and people were all talking about baking with lower protein flours, figuring out the recipes, reskilling around these different flours. So, you know, I think that it's all kind of happening. It's just a matter of everybody, you know, tuning into what other people are talking about and passing the knowledge along. And it's so exciting. You're really in a good place, Jacob. I'm impressed with your timing.
I agree. I think we are in a good place and at a good time. It's really exciting to see what's going on elsewhere and realize that we're part of a sort of a larger story happening all across the U.S. And what I find most interesting about where we are is that, you know, for a lot of these I guess new wheat projects and flour projects, it's in places that historically grew wheat but no longer grow wheat because the land base just doesn't financially support it, like in the Northeast and elsewhere. But what's interesting about us is that we're surrounded by wheat, and we're surrounded by huge mills, General Mills and other large flour mills. And so, you know, it'll be interesting as we continue down this path in the sort of the artisanal route, how that will play into what we're doing. I mean, we're growing wheat in our little field right next to our large-scale neighbor who's also growing wheat. And we're going to try to mill this grain for flour in the same, you know, region that there's four or five other mills. And so it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, if it does at all. I mean, we're obviously not competing with them, but we're not growing wheat in a place that used to grow wheat. We're growing wheat and grinding flour in a place that does this all around us all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So in that sense, your ultimate success could be measured that if you prove profitability, you know, in your business, that others will be convinced that they too should consider growing more artisanally, growing organically, and milling locally. So you're going to have to get ready to be happy and smiling when other people want to jump in bed with your project, I guess.
yeah, perhaps. I mean, more ideal than that would be to bring on new young farmers to do this rather than have some of these existing older farmers grow the varieties we're growing. I mean, I would rather have new folks come on the scene and find their 15 acres and grow along with us.
And perhaps those older growers are also wishing that there were more young folks and more young babies around in the landscape and would be willing to, you know, give the next set of growers a chance. Like a year or two from now, and it's when you've got your systems down and you have enough infrastructure for yourself and maybe even enough infrastructure, you know, for a couple other growers, or maybe, I don't know, I don't want to talk too far in the future, but cooperation. And, you know, what I've been noticing a lot in the magical farm access world lately has been older growers noticing the fine efforts of the young farmers in their area and reaching out and giving a chance to those who have proven themselves and also to the next set who are coming along. And in a way that, you know, used to be, I think, much more common in agricultural areas, saying, okay, kid, here's 15 acres. Knock yourself out. And I just heard a couple stories again this week of those kinds of things happening. Obviously, that doesn't address the long-term.
I would hope it would happen around here.
What?
I would hope that it would happen around here. We're also in a place that doesn't have a large population to support. Well, it's the reason why my wife and I are here is because this is our home. If we were thinking strictly from a business standpoint, we wouldn't move to north central Montana to start a direct market, diverse farm. We would move closer to a bigger city. So there is that challenge for any small-scale direct market growers around here is the market. not a lot of people to sell to.
I know, this is the thing. I mean, and I just was up in Essex, New York, which is where Essex Farm is, and now there's, I think, 6 small farms, and there's a really great new movie I have to promote called Small Farm Rising that's about 3 of those farms. And there they are in the middle of the Adirondacks, where the, you know, local economy is seriously depressed. It's the 2nd poorest county in New York, and there's all these folks growing wonderful, fabulous food. And the, you know, the question really becomes, well, how do we build the economy in this place back up to the point where people can afford to pay for the food at what it costs to grow it? And so obviously the rural exodus has major downsides in terms of having enough people to feed, you know, in smaller towns and even tiny towns.
Right. And I mean, that's one of the many reasons why we really want to focus our efforts on the grain, is because our market expands, because it's storable, and we don't have to worry about getting it to market as soon as it's been harvested. So we do make, you know, 100-mile journeys to deliver our grain, and it's expensive, but it's a nice option.
So that's the answer in those kinds of places is jam, meat, beef, jerky, dried things, portable, durable products.
Right.
But you say that you have a CSA, so that's a local part too, isn't it?
What's that?
Is your CSA locally based?
Yeah, so there certainly is a small market for the vegetables, and that's what we're trying to tap into. And we have some friends who started a farm the year after we did, close to us too. So it's happening slowly. All our vegetables are within a 60-mile, 70-mile radius. We sell to within a 60, 70-mile radius.
Well, Jacob, here's my last question for you. Maybe you could tag a few of the resources that have been of tremendous support to you or inspiration, but then also, if there was a magical fairy who was listening to this radio program, what would you ask of the magical fairy?
Oh, boy, a magical fairy. Magical fairy, would you like to come out and help us weed this summer?
good call. Okay.
Yeah.
And then resources.
Resources. I always have to give a shout out to ATRA, and I know a lot of the young farmers who you interview mention them as well. I think they do tremendous work, and I haven't recently been following, but I know that their funding got cut, and they need all the help they can get. So ATRA's always been a good resource, and for us here, Montana's a pretty big state, but it's as far as the sustainable, local, organic food and ag community goes, it's a pretty small community. In other words, we all tend to know each other, no matter how far away. For, you know, 500 miles away, we all know each other, and so I find a lot of resources in all those people that are part of our larger community, and people who we can call up and ask them questions, or if we're in the neighborhood, go visit their farm, and they give us a lot of help.
A campesina on the High Plains.
That's right.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and I just give you fair warning, I'm going on cowboy tour in late June and early July, because I'm making a new movie and figuring out all of my stories. So you're on my list, and they'll be hearing from me soon.
Well, that
maybe
would be
I'll
great.
Come
yeah,
and help you weed
welcome.
For a little while.
That'd be great. You're more than welcome to come out.
Okay, party
course,
people, thank you for listening. Thank you. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. What did you say?
Well, I was just going to say, any of your listeners are also more than welcome to come out. We love visitors.
Yeah, well, if you come, you better bring some beer. That's my guidance whenever anybody wants to go visit farmers. You better bring some beer.
That's
okay.
Good.
Enough of that chit-chattiness. Thank you all for joining us again, and I hope you will continue to listen and continue to work. And if you're sitting in the greenhouse listening on your iPhone, iCreature, whatever it is, do consider checking out our list of mobile apps and the list of useful farm technologies that's on farmhack.net. It's an open source list, so if you have other iCreature compatible farm useful technologies to add, you can just add them right in. That's at farmhack.net. Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks, Evan.
Bye.